才艺媒体营开始报名喽！七月共两个梯次，五月十五号前想早鸟价，请上网搜寻空音才艺媒体营。
Advanced Studio Classroom is on the air. Ride through history with us today on Advanced.Hello, listeners. Welcome to Advanced Studio Classroom. My name is Peter. It is good to have you with us here today, Wednesday, April 30th, 2025, to read through our book review article for the month of April in your Advanced magazine. And today we will read about a book called The Horse.A Galloping History of Humanity. That is not merely the title of our article today, that is also the title of the book that the article is discussing. How the History of Man and Horse Shaped Our World. So a lot of interesting ground to cover today, and as always, some good vocabulary along the way to talk about and unpack and help you grow in your confidence in speaking English and reading English. And to do that, I will not be alone here in the studio with you, dear listeners. Joining us also is our wonderful panelist, Rhonda. Hello, Rhonda.
Hello, Peter. I'm glad to be here to keep you from being lonely, and thank you for that nice compliment. I hope I can do a wonderful job.
I'm sure you will, Rhonda. So, as we say, this is an article, a book review article, and the book is about horses and their role in shaping the history of humankind. So we are talking about horses today, but more broadly, we're talking about history as well. And so just to get us in the mood for this, I'd like to share a question with my co-panelists here and also with our listeners. They can be thinking about it as we talk about it here in the studio. And that question is, speaking of history, if you had a time machine, a machine you can take to go back to any period or even a particular day in the history of humankind. I know there's more history than that in the greater universe, but today let's limit ourselves to the history of humankind. Where, Rhonda, would you go back to in your time machine? And let's be clear, you cannot change the course of history. When you go back there, you will just be an observer. You cannot be harmed by anything that happens. If you wanted to go back and visit a war, for example, you would have a front row seat for that battle, and they would not see you. You would not influence them in any way. You would be invisible. You would not affect the outcome in any way. You would be purely a spectator. So, with that in mind, Rhonda, what would you set the controls on your time machine for?
Well, that's a fascinating question, and my mind is bouncing around through different eras, so I'm going to choose something more of personal interest. I would go back to 1850 in the middle of America, the Midwest, where I'm from, and be there to see the farmland that my great-great-grandfather settled in before, follow me on this, before the sod was turned.
The sod, S-O-D, sod.
Yes, I grew up in what's considered some of the best farmland in the world in Illinois, but there was a time when the first white settlers had not come, so instead of fields of uniform corn, there was a time when it was wild prairie. So I think I would float in my bubble over the prairie to see it in its natural form. What do you think about that? That's no great famous battle, but just to see the place I grew up in before it became farmed land and small towns and eventually big cities.
Yeah, no, I think that's actually fascinating. And that is one of the wonderful benefits of the time machine exercise that we're doing here. I've been asking it for a lot of years, often with church small groups, or I used to work in the theater, sometimes ask it of actors just to, at the beginning of rehearsal, just to get the imagination going. But in the past, in the history of this question. I have myself tended to answer it in terms of a particular event in history that I would want to go to, like the American Civil War, say, or some, you know, the fall of the Roman Empire, maybe, or a particular person. I would like to go back to, say, to see Martin Luther, to see in person the great Protestant reformer, or perhaps Julius Caesar, the great Roman general and emperor. But more and more, I don't know if it's an effect of putting on years, but I'm struck by the impulse in my time machine to go back to something that is not known to general world history, but is important to me in some way, just like you said, to see land where you grew up, what it was like before you were there, several generations before you were there, I think you said. And yeah, I'm thinking about that too. At the same time, though, it would be pretty neat to see Julius Caesar or some other figure or event in history. But yeah, obviously we've got a time machine, so we have all the time in the world,
as
they say.
I don't know if I would want to be in the middle of a civil war, just saying, even though you are in the bubble.
I think I'd like to see it for maybe 5 minutes,
just
to see how gritty it was, you know, again, without any possibility of being harmed myself. And just to, I mean, in a way, this is the times we live in, but in a way to see how well the movies have captured it, you know, how accurate it really was. Yeah, I think for myself, I would like to go back to see the great English defeat of the Spanish Armada in, I want to say that's about the 15th century, the 16th or 15th century. The country of Spain had a great fleet of ships, navy ships, with which they ruled much of Europe, and somehow the English Navy or the English Army, probably the Navy, was able to defeat the great Spanish Armada in a decisive battle led by Sir Francis Drake, I believe is the name of the commander in charge of it all, and it's this, it was one of the great upsets in military history, in naval history for that matter. And I'd like to see that. I mean, I'd like to see, you know, think of the kind of ships we're talking about is like Johnny Depp in Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, those great huge wooden ships with cannons and big billowing sails, and just to see a real battle among ships like that, I suppose partly because they haven't made a movie about that yet.
There you go.
You know, where I've really had that experience.
Right.
I mean, you get a taste of it in something like Pirates of the Caribbean. There is also, let me correct myself a little bit here, speaking of movies, there is also a good movie called Master and Commander,
yes,
starring Russell Crowe,
yes,
which takes place a few hundred years after the defeat of the Spanish Armada. The Russell Crowe movie takes place around the time of the Napoleonic Wars, so this is about early 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
But it is still the same basic kind of ship,
mm-hmm,
those big, wooden, dramatic
mm-hmm
ships. So if you are, in that movie, there's no great naval battle. There's just, you know, you don't see more than maybe two or three ships in a particular scene together. But even there, they do a great job of capturing some sense of what it must have been like and how ships like that actually fought. So again, that is Master and Commander, starring Russell Crowe, and available pretty much everywhere. It's a fairly popular movie, was nominated for some Oscars, and I do recommend it. But I also recommend that we return to our article now and continue focusing not on a particular era of history or a particular event, but on a particular thing, in this case, a horse, and how the horse influenced the history of humanity. So let's open our magazines, if you haven't already, to the book review again for April 30th, and let's go into our first reading now.
The Horse, A Galloping History of Humanity. How the history of man and horse shaped our world. Some might suggest that a doorstopper about the influence of the horse on human history couldn't possibly be interesting. Nay, say I, nay. In fact, Timothy C. Wingard's The Horse is fascinating, offering a fresh perspective on how crucial horses were in human development. And it almost didn't happen. Abrupt climate changes at the end of the Ice Age drove horses to the edge of extinction. The remnants of an animal once found through much of the world were then largely confined to an area that runs roughly from Eastern Europe to Central Asia, where they were hunted for food. How horses reshaped the world. The horse might have gone the way of its brethren had it not been domesticated like cattle. When someone decided to jump on the back of one of the more docile horses, it started a revolution that changed the world. Riding horses helped farmers herd more sheep and goats, and hunters cover more ground. When horses replaced oxen, their quicker gait allowed more land to be plowed, increased yields, and changed subsistence farmers to commodity exporters.
Okay, so right up front we have a quote from our book here in our first line, and it's basically just a quote that describes the thesis of the book, the influence of the horse on human history. But our author adopts a position here. He claims to be speaking for some, and that's of course short for some people. And so he says basically that some people would say that a book about the influence of the horse on human history couldn't possibly be interesting. Rhonda, why does he put that position?
Well, because it's so big and so long and it sounds a little dull.
Mm-hmm.
He calls the book, this is interesting, a door stopper. This is a fun metaphor that I've actually never heard a joke about. A door stopper is that item that's so large, it holds a door open, right? And in this case, it's a way to talk about a book that you wouldn't want to read because it's so long, so you just put it down on the floor and hold the door open.
Well, that's
no?
maybe a little overinterpreting, but certainly a book that is so large that it could be used to hold a door open.
Oh, okay.
Whether that automatically means something you wouldn't want to read is perhaps a more subjective decision, but yeah, certainly the term is used as a kind of jeer, as a kind of insult, a kind of...
So you've heard it before,
a door stopper.
I have not heard it. Like, would you say something like, well, that's a door stopper of
a book? And it usually isn't used as a compliment.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's fair to say that the implication is, oh, it's just a big, long book by an author who loves the sound of his own voice and, you know, somehow got it published. But, and it's a fair, the author is not just arbitrarily using this word door stopper to describe the book. The book, as we see, is 544 pages long.
Whoa.
So it is a large book. This is your average book, I would say, your average nonfiction book is probably in the neighborhood of 200 to 300 pages, maybe a little more than that. So anything over 500, you're getting into a pretty large book, and a book that looks pretty large too, large enough, in fact, to hold open a door. So yes, the author is saying that there are some people who say a book this big on the influence of the horse in human history couldn't possibly be interesting. The author's own personal response, and again, this is the author of the article, not the book. The author of the article, his response to that claim is nay. Nay, say I, nay. And we have a bit of wordplay here. Nay, N-E-I-G-H, is the word, the English word, that is used to describe the sound a horse makes. You can judge for yourselves how accurate it is, but generally when we do an imitation of a lion, you know, we do a roar. And so R-O-A-R became a word that, you know, means the roar of a lion. And in English language cultures, at least, people thought that when a horse makes a noise, it sounds like neigh, neigh. And so the word N-E-I-G-H has arose to convey that. But there is an additional dimension to this, which makes it appropriate to use at this point in the article. And Rhonda, what do I mean by that?
We have in English the word N-A-Y, that is an old-fashioned way of saying no.
Right.
Nay.
So,
nay, said he.
Right. Nay meaning no, and nay, meaning the sound a horse makes, sound the same. And so our author is having some fun here and saying that no, a book that is so big about the influence of the horse on human history, so big that you could call it a doorstopper, could possibly be interesting. It is not true that it could not possibly be interesting. Nay, it is not true. So anyway, our author, Timothy C. Weingard, goes on to say that, it is Timothy Weingard who wrote The Horse, but here it's the author of the article who's talking. Our article author says that the book is fascinating, offering a fresh perspective on how crucial horses were in human development. And here's the thought, it almost didn't happen. Rhonda, why did it almost not happen?
Fascinating. Abrupt climate changes at the end of the Ice Age drove or pushed horses to the edge of extinction. So the Ice Age is the most recent time in the past when a large part of the world was covered with ice. Our listeners probably have heard a lot about the Ice Age and climate conversations that go on, so it's perhaps already known to our listeners. And it says it, again, kind of a metaphor here, drove the horses or pushed them to the edge, not a literal cliff edge, but the edge of extinction, of disappearing as a species.
Yes, and he goes on to say, the remnants of an animal once found through much of the world, remnants meaning a small piece or amount of something that is left from a larger original piece or amount, in this case, the remnants of horses, or an animal like a horse, once found throughout much of the world, were then, after the Ice Age, were then largely confined to an area that runs roughly from Eastern Europe to Central Asia, so that's about from Ukraine to Western China, say, where they were hunted for food. And that was a line Rhonda and I were talking about off the air. Imagine a world where there are so many horses around that you hunt them for food. I think even in our age of automobiles and airplanes, we still see the value of a horse in a way that seems like there's so much more you could do with them than eat them, that this really takes us back to a significantly different time in human history where they just viewed their world in a much different way from the way we do. So it goes on then to say that the horse might have gone the way of its brethren. Brethren, a word there simply meaning brothers. It's an old-fashioned term, kind of like nay, we were talking about a moment ago, N-A-Y, to say no. Brethren is a kind of old-fashioned word for brothers, which is its essential meaning. The horse might have gone the way of its brethren had it not been domesticated like cattle. When, it goes on to say, and domesticated, there's a word just to understand, that means when we take a wild animal, when someone or peoples take a wild animal and train it and break it, there's, for want of a better word, break its wild spirit and tame it and train it to serve the needs of human beings. Domestication. So had horses not been domesticated like cattle. And then there's this wonderful next line, when someone decided to jump on the back, what happened, Rhonda, when someone did decide to jump on the back?
Well, it started a revolution. That's what happened. They jumped on the back of a quiet horse, one of the more docile horses, docile meaning quiet and easy to control. It started a revolution that changed the world.
Right, right. And then in our final paragraph of our first section here, the author points out how something in horses, not just something, it goes on to say that riding horses, as opposed to eating them, riding horses helped farmers herd more sheep and goats. Herd, of course, just meaning manage them, raise them and manage them, organize them. And it helped hunters to cover more ground, but it also allowed more land to be plowed. Rhonda, why did it allow more land to be plowed?
Because horses could move more quickly. They had a quicker gait, a quicker walk.
Mm-hmm. That changed farming. We talked about farming just a moment ago in terms of being able to herd more sheep and goats riding horses, but it also changed farming from subsistence, it changed farmers from subsistence farmers to commodity exporters. Some big long words there. Subsistence farmer or subsistence farming simply means farming that is done simply to provide the goods required by the farm family and not with any significant surplus of crops or animals that could then be sold to raise money as in a business. But now that farmers had horses once they started riding them, then their quicker gait, their speed, allowed more land to be plowed, which increased yields, which increased the harvest, and changed subsistence farmers to, we might say, for-profit farmers, or as the article puts it, commodity exporters. They could now raise food not just for their family, but raise food as a commodity to be sold, like corn and potatoes and animals as well, such as sheep or cattle or cows. So already we're getting a real sense here of the influence of horse, this single animal, the horse, which had previously been breakfast, basically, has now already, and this is still in ancient times, had this great impact on human society. Let's read a little bit more about it now in our second section. Let's do that now.
Inevitably, horses became instruments of war. First pulling archers ensconced in chariots and then as mounts. The earliest known true cavalry formation belonged to the Assyrian king Tolkoti Ninturta II, ruled 890 to 884 BCE. In relatively short order, cavalry units made the difference in battle. Those nations that had horses won wars. Those that didn't tried to get them. In many ways, these conflicts created the world we have today. Alexander extended the boundaries of his empire and Greek culture through Persia, India, and beyond because of the success of his cavalry. Moorish invaders brought math and science to Europe. Horses were the deciding element in the Battle of Hastings, where William, the Duke of Normandy, who had cavalry units, soundly defeated the Anglo-Saxon King Harold Godwinson, creating the modern British state. The horse is extensively researched. It is interesting, charming, and entertaining. But I know, I can lead you to a bookstore, but I can't make you read.
Okay, so perhaps inevitably we do learn here now in our second section, horses did become instruments of war. Rhonda, how did that happen according to our first section here?
Well, first they were used to pull archers, soldiers with bows and arrows, who were ensconced or seated safely in their chariots. And then horses were used as mounts. You mounted, sat upon the horse.
Right, right. And the name for the military use of horses, or the part of an army that rides on horses, is cavalry. The earliest known, it says here, the earliest known true cavalry formation belonged to the Assyrian king Tukulti Ninurta II. And I must say, if you've spent any time at all in ancient history, you've got to be impressed with the names of the Assyrian kings.
Yes.
Tiglath-Pileser III, I think, is another one I've come across in my readings, but Tukulti Ninurta II. That's a kingly name, if you don't mind my saying so.
And Peter, speaking of pronouncing and difficult names, cavalry is a word that even we native speakers often mess up. It's important to get the V before the L. Every time I start to say a unit of horses for military, I stop and say, cavalry, because there's another word that sounds like it, cavalry.
Right, cavalry. And Rhonda, what does cavalry mean?
Well, cavalry is the name of a hill that was outside of ancient Jerusalem, and it's very important in Christian history.
Exactly, but quite different. A hill, if it's cavalry, and horses in the army, if it's cavalry. It's tricky. It's tricky even for native speakers. But we give you all the information you need here on Advanced. But let's just move down to near the end of our article here. We learn how the cavalry units made the difference in battle. Horses or rather nations that had horses, won wars, and those that didn't tried to get them. The great Greek commander Alexander the Great, was able to extend the boundaries of his empire and the Greek culture that went with that, largely because of the success of his cavalry, the horses. And Moorish invaders, that is to say Arab or Spanish Muslims in the Middle Ages, brought math and science to Europe as they invaded Europe on horseback. So we come then finally to the last line of the entire article today, in which we have a little bit more wordplay. Our author says the horse is extensively researched. The book, it is extensively researched. It is interesting, charming, and entertaining. But I know I can lead you to a bookstore, but I can't make you read. And there is just a little more horse humor there. There's an English expression, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. And it's used to mean that you can entice someone to do something, not necessarily just a horse, but any person. You can entice them, you can encourage them to do it, you can advise them to do it, but ultimately they're the ones that actually do it, and that's what you cannot do, is literally compel or force them to do it. You can only try to persuade them to do it. You can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink, and our author can lead you to a bookstore to buy a book about horses, but he can't make you read it. So anyway, listeners, that is all the time we have for today. We're glad you joined us and hope that this has got you thinking about horses and history and a particular book on horses in history. Again, the author's name is Timothy C. Weingard. But for today, we must bid you adieu as we ride off into the sunset. I'm Peter.
I'm Rhonda.
Saying bye-bye.
Bye-bye.